Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 74. On this episode of the podcast, we are talking about Black Mass. Black Mass is based on a book called Black Mass, and then has a much longer title that follows that, so I'll let you look that up. But it stars an array of actors, most of whom you've heard of, and it's actually pretty impressive that this cast has gotten together. Johnny Depp, Joel Edgerton, Benedict Cumberbatch, Dakota Johnson, Kevin Bacon, Peter Sarsgaard, Jesse Plemons, Adam Scott, Corey Stahl, etc., etc., etc. So because the cast was so big, this was hailed as something that might be a comeback for Johnny Depp. We just couldn't stay away, so we had to check it out. And checking it out with me from the More Than One Lesson podcast and Battleship Pretension podcast is Tyler Smith rejoining us on the show. And with him is our very own Josh Crabb from Real World Theology. And we just want to make sure you guys are following their stuff. So check out realworldtheology.com, where we have show notes and we'll have links to all the stuff they're doing, because it's great. They did great as always. So check out the website, realworldtheology.com, where we have reviews, top five lists, streaming recommendations, podcasts. Check us out on Facebook, where we have updates. We let you know when new stuff's coming up, whether it be in the greater film world or with Real World Theology in specific. Follow us on Twitter at Real World Theo. Subscribe to the podcast, and you can look for new episodes of the podcast near or on the 1st, 10th, or 20th of the month. And you can follow us on Feedburner, Stitcher, and iTunes. If you like the show, rate the show, review the show, tell your friends, and let's get more people involved in the conversation. We really, really appreciate those of you who have to this point. It's been excellent. We've gotten lots of feedback. We've started a couple new series with a new version of Whoology, and we are getting great conversations there, so keep that up. And this is going to be a really great show for you. So here it is. Episode 74, Black Mass and Relative Goodness. Movie theaters are modern day pulpits. Real World Theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless. Well, okay, so let me ask you a question that I imagine anyone listening to this podcast is probably tired of me asking people, which is, how do you feel about the 2015 film year to this point, comparative maybe to last year or previous years, and how do you think that how do you think it's going to end, as far as, like, do you think,
I mean, as far as box office,
well, not just box office, but like, I think 2015 years down the road, because of some of the classier films, some of the better, like arguably better films that have come out and that may still come out, along with the blockbustery type films like Furious 7, Avengers, Jurassic World, whether Star Wars is good or bad, I think people will look back at 2015 and say that was a major year in film. And like I said, we don't know how it's going to round out, but I'm fairly optimistic based on who's directing and starring in most of the films that are coming out for the rest of the year, and the strength of schedule that I feel we've gotten up to this point in 2015. So,
yeah, I feel like you used the right word. You said major. You didn't necessarily say good.
Yeah.
You know, this is a big year because you have stuff like Jurassic World doing crazy numbers. You have Avengers, you have Furious 7, and that's just the first few months of the year. Mm-hmm. But then you also have James Bond, Hunger Games, Star Wars, you know, and any number of other things. And so, like, so just as far as like big tentpole flagship films, you've got that. But then, I don't know. I'm interested to know how people will think of it as far as like independent film. I don't recall it being like a really great, I mean, there's, I don't have my own list up right now, my Letterboxd, but, But yeah, I feel like by and large, I've been kind of ambivalent about the year. Like I feel pretty good about most of the movies than my current top 10, but yeah, it's to me, like, the year is usually defined by the last 3 or 4 months. Yeah. Anyway.
So, and the reason I'm hesitant at all, even though, again, I feel like for the most part, we've got a pretty strong year. And even, I mean, independent-wise, I don't think we've had an amazing year, but I still think there's been stuff that has surprised and counts as quality, because we just podcasted on It Follows, which I think was a surprise hit. Ex Machina has been a favorite from a lot of critics and a lot of people who enjoy.
That's my second favorite of the year right now.
Yeah, so there you go. And then Mad Max has come out, which isn't an independent film, obviously. But yeah, it is a huge surprise, you know, a movie that will probably end up be the benchmark for action movies for some time to come, you know? So yeah, when you add that, I take that either popularity, that majorness, and some of that really goodness, I mix it in and I look towards the end of the year and I see films that are going to be directed by, you know, Spielberg and Iñárritu, Del Toro, you know, like, we have a whole bunch of major players, and all those films are bringing just oodles and oodles of noodles or star power to those films. So I'm more optimistic that we're going to get more studs than duds, I hope. Not that that makes any sense, but we're talking about, or we're going to be talking about Black Mass. And I think the irony to my optimism is probably Black Mass, because Black Mass right now is kind of sitting at a solid meh with most critics.
Yeah.
But we have a director who's in Scott Cooper, who's made Crazy Heart, which won some Oscars, Out of the Furnace, which most people didn't like, though there were things about it to kind of like. It's based on a book that people thought was pretty good. And it's got such an ensemble that I think we're going to be hard pressed, except for maybe The Martian, to hit an ensemble cast that has this much star power. Between Johnny Depp, Joel Edgerton, Benedict Cumberbatch, Dakota Johnson, Kevin Bacon, Peter Sarsgaard, and Adam Scott, I'm just going to just name everybody, Corey Stahl, Juno Temple, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, it's hard to imagine this much talent crammed into one movie and it being really good. But it wasn't really what I wanted it to be. So I ask you guys, did you guys like Black Mass 1? And, you know, part 2 is kind of like, what were you expecting? Because I've kind of set it up, at least, or it was set up in my mind, like, solid director, amazing cast. We're getting to the late September, early October time frame when we start getting Oscar movies. So I had pretty high expectations. So where were your expectations, and how did Black Mass finally settle for you guys? Tyler.
Well, I should say that I read the book Black Mass many years ago. I don't remember a lot of, I remember, you know, the basic details that everybody remembers, and just a little bit, you know, a little bit more detail. And so, and when I read it, I thought, like, wow, this seems like it would be a good movie. And I know that that Jack Nicholson's character in The Departed, and a lot of The Departed in general, was sort of inspired by the story of Whitey Bulger. But when I heard that it was, when I saw that it was announced, I thought, okay, let's take a look at this cast, because a movie like this kind of lives or dies by that. And I was like, this is a pretty solid cast. Mm-hmm. I thought Johnny Depp, who has not been a big thing for me lately, but, you know, when I think of him in, say, like Finding Neverland or Public Enemies, or Donnie Brasco or something like that, it's like, all right, he can tone this down if he needs to. He doesn't have to be over the top. He can be pretty subtle. And so I thought, like, all right, I'll bet he's going to kind of play the characters pretty focused and pretty laser-like and that sort of thing. But so I was kind of hoping to like it. I didn't have much association with Scott Cooper. I saw Crazy Heart and liked it, but did not think it was a directorial effort by any stretch of the imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And then let's see. And then I didn't see Out of the Furnace. And so I just remember thinking like, all right, this does seem sort of like a, it seems like this material should have been given to somebody better or somebody with more of a directorial style, mm-hmm. but you know, that's fine. And so, and I had seen that critics didn't necessarily love it, but didn't necessarily hate it either. So yeah. I went to see it yesterday and my reaction to it was mostly positive. It is looking at my list of movies of the year. It is number 23 on my list out of 48. So that's like smack dab in the middle. But I should say that like anything above 30 is pretty good. It means that I had a pretty good response to it.
Okay.
I do, and we can get into the specifics a little bit later. I think that whatever problem the film has is with the is at the screenwriting level. More specifically, the storytelling, because I think the dialogue is fine, but I think in how you choose to tell a story, especially a biopic, I feel like you have at this point we've seen it all before.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like you got to find a new and fresh way to make one. For example, the film Love and Mercy is number 7 on my list, partially because I thought they found a really interesting way of telling the story of Brian Wilson.
Yeah, another biopic. Just
right. So I feel, and again, we can go more into it later. So I'll just say that for the most part, I liked it. There are scenes that I really responded to, performances I really responded to. But it is by no means perfect and is not remarkably memorable, which is unfortunate given how memorable this story actually is.
I think that it's pretty similar to how I feel, because I just did a quick tally, and apparently I've seen 36 films this year, which means you were schooling me. But this one ends up at 19 on my list. So I think roughly about the same place.
Now you're going to make me do it too.
Did you do what I told you to and make a list in Evernote and just always get them right there? Or are you doing
Letterboxd? Oh no, I'm just going to my Letterboxd. I usually keep that pretty up to date. So,
all right.
I'm already rolling out my sponsor for every episode, right?
Letterboxd, where you can go to talk to Josh.
Maybe I didn't respond quite as well. Mine's like 37 out of 44.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
So explore that. What were you expecting going in, Josh?
Well, I guess, you know, the initial hype kind of surrounding the movie was definitely like, oh, Johnny Depp is great. You know, Johnny Depp is, you know, kind of back to where he used to be, you know, in some other movies. He's not the you know, swaggering drunk in Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, that he has been for four, now five movies soon.
Yeah.
So I went in with a little bit higher expectations, kind of thinking like, okay, well, this could be, you know, a good biopic. Maybe had a little bit higher expectations, or like Get On Up or something like that. Just because, you know, I mean, the star power too. I mean, you think about it, when you see that Johnny Depp and Benedict Cumberbatch are going to be in the same movie, you kind of think like, this has got to be pretty,
yeah. How could this
pretty spectacular. So going into it, I had pretty high expectations and maybe that tempered it a little, but I think similar to what Tyler said, there were scenes in the movie. You know, I've kind of jokingly spread everywhere that like, we can get into that part later, so I'll save that joke for later. put that one in my front pocket. But you know, I kind of went in the movie with some expectations and kind of left the movie kind of like, all right, well, there was some stuff that I responded to. There was other stuff that I didn't respond to as well. And I just felt like for most of the movie, it wasn't like I was bored. It wasn't like when I saw Insurgent and I wanted to tear my face off and find some way to end my life before this movie ended, or it just kept going. But, you know, I kind of left just kind of like, all right, well, you know, it was a movie, and that's kind of where my star rating ends up. I guess that's what I call the 2.5 star rating on Letterboxd. Well, it was a movie.
It was a movie.
You know, like I just ultimately I felt like it was kind of dull. Like the story was not very, like, kind of what Tyler had already said. The story wasn't very interesting. What was being told wasn't as interesting as it probably could have been.
Mm.
Well, based on, you know, you figure a guy who has been convicted or at least charged with 19 murders, you probably have at least something compelling to tell about him.
So, well, and the thing is, I think the issue is, I'm sorry to interrupt.
No problem.
I think the issue is that they're telling the wrong story.
Mm.
And I'm certainly not the only person to be saying this, but it's like, look, I know Whitey Bulger was a real guy, and he did. You know, if you want to make a movie about that, that's fine. But you have to recognize that we've seen Goodfellas, we've seen The Godfather, we've seen Donnie Brasco, we've seen The Departed, we've seen Casino, we've seen all of these, and true care, like real life person or not, we've seen this kind of brutality before. What we haven't really seen is John Connolly's story. I feel like that's the lead. That's who you should have been focusing on. Whitey be just sort of this ever-present menacing figure, but you have this FBI guy who is trying to do the right thing, but also has this weird sense of loyalty to his neighborhood. And also recognizes that he could stand to go way up in the department or way up in the bureau if he makes this unholy alliance with Whitey. And so I feel like those scenes feel way more electric to me, even though nobody is officially dying. Those scenes feel more electric to me than the gangster scenes.
Well, I would say I think a number of critics would argue that even though it is being advertised as a story about Whitey Bulger, it actually is a story based on who's mostly focused on, who has a story arc in this film. It is about Connolly.
Yeah, I guess that's what I was thinking as I left the movie. It was like it didn't make a lot of sense that the movie seemed to be being billed as a story about Whitey Bulger when it seemed like kind of just like you said, Tyler, it's almost like Whitey just kind of did enter the scenes, and it almost would have been better if they had made choices to kind of make him like loom more in the background of like Connolly's story instead of making him the focus of some different scenes. Cause you know, I mean, it kind of felt like, that Connolly was the story there, but it's like they almost got confused. It was almost like, no, but we need to focus on Bulger. Mm-hmm. We need to focus on him instead. And so it didn't. Yeah. And maybe that's why it felt dull is because the story has already been done before.
Mm-hmm.
Cause like you said, it was another gangster movie. It felt like at the end of the day, instead of something really unique or interesting,
but not even a gangster movie. Like a gangster documentary.
Yeah.
Except without like that narrative arc of a documentary taking us from like humble beginnings to, you know, ultimate power to ultimate fall. We just get thrown into the middle of a series of actions that are happening. Like I said, I think, you know, both of you guys have pointed out that we don't get a lot of arc with Bulger like we do in other type picks that we've seen, and like Tyler, like you pointed out, we've already seen the gangster movie. What is this? How are you going to tell us a story that we haven't seen before? Why are we coming to the theater? Especially since there's already been movies like The Departed that are heavily influenced by the story of Whitey Bulger, who basically tell an arc of a story that we want to see. So, like, what are you doing different? Why are you bringing all these A-list actors in? To tell what story, and instead it ends up being like a set of facts. Like Bulger went here, Bulger did a thing. Connolly went here, Connolly did a thing. But despite all that, I think something that both of you has also hit on that I want to ask, kind of plainly, as it seems to be the topic of conversation. before we get into, I guess, thematic type things, is this has been billed as a return to form for Johnny Depp. And I would say that people who even have a problem with the film being a set of facts instead of having a story arc and things like that, the majority of people, I believe, have enjoyed Johnny Depp's performance. And we all have all mentioned that there were performances that you connected with. And I'm wondering, is it actually a return to form for Johnny Depp, in your opinions? Like, did he nail this thing as best he could?
I think yes. It's hard to say if it's a return to form, because exactly what was that form? Like, he's been pretty amorphous for a while. Mm-hmm. And I mean that in a good way. You know, like, he follows up Pirates of the Caribbean with Finding Neverland, like, such different performances. Mm-hmm. You know, he did Donnie Brasco, and then the following year he does Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Like, it's, there's no real form to him. It's more just, is this another good performance that he's done, which he hasn't done in a while? Has he mm-hmm. been able to rein it in? And I think so. I think, you know, I think he understands where the writing is, and I think he understands when he gets a good scene. For example, the scene at Connolly's house when he first is, sort of threatening that guy about the recipe for steak marinade.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's a wonderful scene, written beautifully. He knows just the right tone to play. And then later on, when he's threatening John Connolly's wife, I think that's a bit on the nose, but I think his performance is good. Like, it's just, mm-hmm. you know, I think he still, despite the kind of clunky storytelling, I think he manages to find the core of this character. And so when the character sees something that means something to him, like, for example, his son, his mother, or the plight of the IRA, mm-hmm. You can see the character sort of come alive, and you suddenly realize, well, he probably doesn't take a great deal of pleasure in the monstrous stuff that he is doing. He sees it as a means to an end, and that those ends are his son, his mother, or I guess you could just say family in general, mm-hmm. and then the IRA, which he seems like to take relish in sympathizing with, maybe because it gives him a cause that's bigger than himself. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like Johnny Depp, you know, really gets to the core of the character. And in my opinion, anytime you do a biopic, you know, the difference between Capote and Ray is that, well, you know, they both won Best Actor, but I feel like I didn't really get to the core of Ray Charles when I saw Ray, whereas I do feel like I got to the core of Truman Capote in Capote. Mm-hmm. And in this, you know, I feel like you need to start at the inside and then work your way out. So that's when you do wigs and accents and stuff like that. But first you have to find out what makes the character tick. And I think Johnny Depp found what makes, at least, you know, maybe not in real life, but I think he found whatever he needed to play this character 100%. And I think he did a really solid job. It's probably not my favorite performance in the film, mm-hmm. but I think he's pretty solid in it.
Josh.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, another good scene is I thought that the opening was pretty great. Like, they didn't decide to open the film with him, like, you know, brutally killing someone. Mm-hmm. You know, they had him kind of being a prickly and persnickety guy about the, you know, his fellow gangster putting his licked fingers in the bowl of nuts.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really interesting beginning to his character. And it kind of sets up, it's like, oh, you kind of get you realize that this guy could be set off by anything. And that's why I felt like he had, like, kind of the Joe Pesci vibe that Pesci had in his gangster movies. You know, kind of like this explosive character that if, you know, he's a little bit off-putting, but if you said the wrong thing, he's just going to explode into violence on you. And I thought that was really great. And so I think Depp did a good job with that. Not as unhinged, you know. Like, I made the comparison in my review to Pesci, but he's not as unhinged as Pesci is in, like, in Goodfellas.
Which is actually one of the things that... Okay, so now we're getting into a weird little preference of mine. I prefer... Irish mob movies to Italian mob movies any day of the week.
Whatever,
whether it be like, Well, like, for example, like Miller's Crossing or State of Grace or even The Departed, which it's Irish, but it was made by an Italian, so it's kind of in the middle. like, it's I think it has to do with, like, when you think about it, you know, what is the difference between Joe Pesci and Johnny Depp in these films? Well, one, like, they both have the capacity for horrible brutality, but one of them, it is an explosion because they can't hold back anymore. The other is, I'm going to focus this, and I'm going to make a cold, hard decision, and that's what I'm going to do. Like, we never see, we only once see Johnny Depp really lose his temper, and it's when his son is in the hospital and he, like, throws a chair around. Like, that's a different kind of thing than when he's dealing with business. And and so I think I enjoy those kinds of movies where, don't get me wrong, I love The Sopranos and I love The Godfather and stuff like that. But there was a show called Brotherhood, which incidentally features, I think, a Rhode Island Irish mobster and his politician brother, played by Jason's Isaac and Clark. And I feel like there's just something about people who do the same things as other mobsters but seem to take no real joy in it. They just kind of do it. It's Road to Perdition is another one. You know, like there's humor in that, but the humor doesn't come from like big outsized personality like in The Sopranos. It comes from, you know, maybe some goofiness of the mob world, but for the most part, there's a real sense of like, well, there's a real sense of a certain kind of Catholicism there where just like, we'll do what we have to do, but we're going to go to hell. Like, and I'm okay with that.
It's very daredevil-ish.
Tyler, have you ever seen the show Peaky Blinders?
I watched an episode of it and then realized that I had already seen Boardwalk Empire and I stopped.
Nice.
No offense. I like all those people. I like Cillian Murphy. I like Sam Neill. But I was just like, I don't have time for another period gangster thing that's just going to be like all the others.
I actually think it's great. But I haven't seen Boardwalk Empire, so that puts me in a different mold. So I thought that may have fit a little bit more. But they're not Irish gangsters. They're British gangsters.
Right.
So...
And I'm sure they're very polite.
Pardon.
Pardon me while I shoot you in the face. So, that was not my actual British accent.
That was totally British accent. There.
That was not British at all.
That is maybe the best British accent I've ever heard.
With that kind of
not
British accent?
Not since Keanu Reeves. Not since Keanu Reeves and Bram Stoker's Dracula have I heard so great a British accent.
Did you think Cumberbatch's Irish or his like Boston accent was all right?
It wasn't bad.
Like it wasn't bad.
No.
But I thought it's like he probably, well, I shouldn't say that because it seems like English people have an easier time doing American accents than Americans have doing British accents, as I just demonstrated for everyone.
Well, I would say that I can safely say that Benedict Cumberbatch's Boston accent was infinitely better than Kevin Costner's British accent in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
He didn't try to do one, right?
Exactly.
There you go. You know what, though? More power to him. Like, better to realize you can't do it and then just not do it.
Or what is it, like, what was that movie where Tom Cruise was trying to kill Hitler?
Valkyrie.
And, like, everyone had, like, all the British people had, like, German accents, but Tom Cruise just kind of walked in and was like, hey, guys, we're going to kill Hitler. I'm German.
As though at some point you expect him to look at the camera, lift up his eye patch and be like, hey folks, it's me, Tom Cruise. Don't you worry. I'm sure I probably threw you with this eye patch, but it's just me.
That would be so great. I feel like that's something I get from like a robot chicken or something.
I think Valkyrie is pretty good, but any movie would be better with an actor looking at the camera and saying, hello, it's me, George Clooney, or whatever. Just for a moment. And then the rest of the movie is like a really sincere exploration of something. But just for one moment, it's like, hey, guys, don't forget, you're watching a movie, and we appreciate your patronage.
I know you're pretty scared right now, but this isn't real. We're just reenacting this thing.
Something and they're like, you know what is scary? Global warming. But then they just turn back to the film.
Yep.
It's like, well, I guess this was a message movie, but they didn't really spend a lot of time on it.
Yeah, so that was a really good movie.
Okay, so
I apologize. Sorry.
No. So the follow up to the follow up's follow up question, because I can do this all day, would be, so what performance did strike you as best? If it wasn't Johnny Depp, what I think we all, you know, we're all saying that he pretty much nailed Bulger in some way. If that wasn't the pinnacle in this one, like who was it?
I think either Joel Edgerton or Peter Sarsgaard.
Okay.
And I, you know, Peter Sarsgaard, he's not in it very much, so it's hard to say that his is the best, but mm-hmm. his is like, his is a character I remember a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like the scene with him and Joel Edgerton is really electric. You know, you have somebody who is himself a murderer and a horrible person, but you have him screaming for protection and screaming for justice. And it's falling on deaf ears because the person sworn to uphold justice is actually not. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like that scene is really, really loaded with stuff. And you have both actors, just working. You have the actors working hard because the characters are working hard. You've got Peter Sarsgaard trying desperately to convince people of something because his life depends on it. And then you have Joel Edgerton, whose freedom and livelihood depends on people believing him.
Mm-hmm.
And so both of them are working really hard to convince not merely each other, but the other people in the room. And it's just it's a wonderful scene. And I think both of them are great in it. And one thing I think Peter Sarsgaard's absolutely electrifying in the film. And, but I think probably Joel Edgerton has, it's hard to say the best performance. To me, it's the most engaging performance because the character is so inherently unlikable.
Mm-hmm.
And he's unlikable in a way, you know, there are characters we love to hate and then there's characters we just hate. And I felt this way about Matt Damon in The Departed. His was my favorite performance because, like, that's genuinely a fearless performance because you know the audience is going to hate you, but you commit 100%.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I felt about Joel Edgerton.
No, I wish I would have really watched The Departed before we did this. It's been so long since I've seen it.
Like, you've watched it before, but you want to really watch it. Like, yeah. Just really lean forward, you know,
do a
Clockwork Orange kind of thing with your eyes.
Just, there's no blinking. It's totally going to be 100% immersed. I will worship at the Scorsese altar or something like that, that intense to it.
You don't have to. It's not that good of a movie.
Yeah, it's all right. So the thing is, there's a whole bunch of movies before I started reviewing stuff that I saw, and I was like, oh, that was good. But there's so much to them, like looking back, just remembering pieces of them, that I was like, if I was really thinking about this film when I watched it, I would have gotten so much more from it. And I think I would have gotten a lot more from The Departed than I did. But tangent. Mm. So Josh, do you think anyone really, like I said, it doesn't have to be like who had the best performance, but, you know, just like a performance that really stood out to you besides Johnny Depp?
Yeah, I mean, I can't argue with Joel Edgerton's performance at all. I think that it was really great. It's just kind of a shame that we didn't get more of that.
Yeah.
But you know, I feel like some of the women in the movie too, and their sort of limited capacities. Cause this, I mean, I think, you know, I think it was Alyssa Wilkinson's review at Christianity Today where she, you know, said it's kind of a boys' club of a movie. But there's a couple different scenes specifically for, you know, women where they're given a chance to shine. And I was kind of taken with, you know, even though Dakota Johnson was only in like two scenes, I was like, oh, okay, I could see what people were talking about in 50 Shades of Grey, which I'm never going to see. So, you know, because they were saying that she was pretty great. And the male lead, I can't remember his name, Jamie something, but he wasn't very good. But I was like, okay, I could see why people are kind of high on her for at least a little bit. And the same thing with Juno Temple, who I was surprised. I completely forgot she was in this movie. And then I was just like, for her, like one or scene, which is a terrifying scene.
Mm-hmm.
And like how her, you know, her end comes about, just horrible. And, you know, I thought with what little bit she had the whole time, I was just like, is that Juno Temple? And I had to find out like while I'm watching the movie, if that's Juno Temple. So, I thought those two were really great, but they're limited. You know, they were kind of small parts, kind of like Skarsgård's performance. His name is hard to say. But you know, Peter Sarsgaard was being, you know, Peter Sarsgaard doing a normal Peter Sarsgaard performance. So,
I don't agree. Peter Sarsgaard usually has a really nice tight control on his emotions. I just saw a movie called Experimenter, in which he plays Stanley Milgram. And when I think of Peter Sarsgaard, I think of a guy who's very tightly wound and contained, whereas this is him just completely just exploding with emotion all the time. But that's just me.
It is just you. And I'll appreciate you keeping those opinions to yourself.
I'm sorry. You can cut that out if you want.
No, because I want to push back on that, because I want to, like, there are different performances that are going to resonate with different people. And one of my issues with the performances in this film is I'm wondering if we would have had a chance to take, I mean, like, Juno Temple, like, it seemed like such a good performance, but we, like, her character randomly shows up. We're given like a line of kind of backstory about why this scene's even in the movie.
Yeah.
There's no real arc to her being there. It's just odd. And so she shows up, she does a good job, and then she's gone. Like, what? It's frustrating for that to be so well done, because where was the rest of it? You know, and same thing with Dakota Johnson. I was just like, okay. I really am connecting with her character. And then once Bulger's son dies, she's just gone. You know, like, we don't hear from her. We don't see her. She doesn't show up. We don't get anything else. And that was kind of frustrating to me. One, because, you know, it points to the fact that this is just a set of circumstances that we're watching instead of some type of story arc. And two, because it just pointed out how good I think the movie could have been with this cast. And, you know, I think it, you know, let us down to a certain degree. Like I said, it kind of ended up being like a meh, but
I feel like I'm sorry. I feel like every time the film, I think the common denominator in what all three of us are saying is, like, every time the film and we felt engaged by the film is when it didn't do the obvious thing. Whether it be Joel Edgerton's performances, his performance or his scenes, or, you know, that scene with, Dakota Johnson. Mm-hmm. You know, those are scenes that they're usually the supporting scenes. They're usually like, and they are here too. And I just thought, like, to go back to my earlier point, which is like, if you're going to make a biopic, do something new with it that we haven't seen before. Mm-hmm. And just like, imagine. Well, you know, one of the reasons that the Sopranos work so well is because just as much, if not more, time is spent on the domestic aspect of these people's lives as the actual criminal. And I feel like with a film like this, you know, we have scenes of Joel Edgerton and his wife, and we see her love him at first and then not like him when it becomes clear what he's been doing. And it's like, I would have loved to see some transitional scenes where she's really. It's not her fault. It's the writing, you know, and I would have liked to see more of Bulger with his girlfriend after the I don't know if she's actually his girlfriend or just the mother of his child, but, like, after the child has died, like, I want to see more of those. I want to see more of Whitey and his brother, or Whitey and his mom. Like, I want to see more of that. I mean, that is, I don't know. This is a big thing that I got out of the book, is it's such a tight-knit community in South Boston that loyalty and family is everything. And so, like, okay, that's fine, but you should, if that's the case, if you really want to give us a sense of place, then show us these relationships. Like, don't, like, you can show us the crime too, that's fine. But we've seen that before in other movies, and we've probably seen it better in other movies.
Yeah.
But if you really focus on the relationships and these characters that in any other movie would be side characters, but here are like co-leads or at least heavy supporting, I feel like the movie becomes much more interesting and much more of a portrait of a place and a mentality more than any one person. And I feel like then you have a really special film. And I feel like they missed that opportunity here.
It's so weird. It seems so obvious, to us sitting here talking about it now, but it seems like someone should have, I mean, just noticed, or, I don't know.
Yeah, but if you're the studio, you just think, like, you know, it's the same reason that there's a million cop and doctor shows on TV, mm-hmm. because it's like, well, let's just go with what's really exciting. You know, let's go with stuff that's like breakneck speed and all that. And it's like, oh, wait, hey, we've secured the rights to this book about Whitey Bulger. It's like, awesome. We're going to make a gangster movie.
Let's just show how terrible he is.
Yeah, and just – and, like, we'll just do – we'll just do your standard gangster movie, but now this is a different guy. But it's all the standard stuff. Like, I feel like a studio wouldn't want to take the risk on doing what the three of us are talking about.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's fair. So something else that was perplexing to me was the fact that it was the title of the film. So I had to look up what a black mass was, because, one, I thought in some way it would seem to be more tied into after watching the film. Like, I would go, oh, okay, I get it. I see what symbolism is. It's explained in some way. Not like there had to be the dude who came out and said, it's like a black mass. You know, we didn't need anyone to come out and give, like, the, you know, get the score for saying the title of the movie. But basically, after it was over, still had no idea. Had to go look it up. And apparently, a black mass is a ritual characterized by the inversion of the traditional Latin mass that's celebrated by the Roman Catholic Church. And apparently, the sole purpose of the mass was, or at least I guess typically, satanic worship and sacrifice to specifically ridicule Christianity. So understanding what black mass is, does that title make more or less sense to you after having seen the film?
It makes a lot. I say this, it makes a lot more sense if you focus on John Connolly.
I think that's
like, if he's the lead, and it's like, he is, what he's doing is a literal mockery of justice. It mm-hmm. is the inversion of what's supposed to be the title. And by the way, the title makes a lot more sense for the book, because John Connolly is as much a, if not more of the focus than Whitey Bulger.
Mm. Mm. Josh.
Yeah, no, I totally, like, I just kind of was like, sure, black mass doesn't even really fit, but, yeah, I mean, I guess I would say the same thing, but that's a really great point. I was just kind of pondering Tyler's point that if it focused more on Connolly, it would kind of look, you know, more like it would seem to fit a lot better. I still wonder, like, I wonder why the authors named the book Black Mass.
Well, so I was reading, because this is one of the worst things that I don't ever want to have to do after I see a movie. Like, Google the phrase, why is this movie named or called blank, you know, like that's something that I should not have to do. There's lots of things.
The movie Naked Lunch.
I want to just, anything would have made more sense. It's like, they could have named the movie like Could Have Strangled Your Wife, or That FBI Goof Up. I mean, like, so many things would have. Anyway.
Steak marinade.
Yeah, see? I mean, like, just as much...
Nice.
Well, actually, more, you know, more relevance than... Anyway. So, I don't want to have to Google that. There's lots of things I want to Google after a film about, you know, how someone got attached to the picture, you know, quotes that I couldn't exactly remember that were really, like, you know, the idea of what was really compelling, fun facts about the film, just because it's so interesting to me how it came together. But... anyway, so having Googled this thing, I saw that someone mentioned that the author was quoted as settling on that name because he thought the FBI's deal with the devil, so to speak, was the inversion of justice. It was they were playing too closely with fire, and it burned them, and that mockery, I believe, Tyler, you said mockery, that mockery of justice, it is from an institution that should be giving you one of the best systems, or delivering justice in one of the most honorable and reliable ways, does one of the most, like, ends up becoming a crime mob, basically. They are the supporters and instigator of this injustice. So, like I said, kind of made sense, but ...
Interesting. I think I'm finally understanding, based on what you guys said, you know, why it might be called Black Mass. And I was thinking, like, you know, that if we're looking at God and who he is compared to how it's, you know, what this, the quality that Bulger and Connolly both have in this movie, I think it was actually, I think this was something I read outside of the movie itself, but there was a quote by Kevin Weeks, the guy played by Jesse Plemons, who said that Bulger had like a Machiavellian quality to him. And there was sort of like that idea was played out in that dinner, other dinner table scene earlier with his son before his son died, you know, where he says, it's not what you do, it's when and where you do it and who you do it to or with.
Mm-hmm.
If nobody sees it, it didn't happen. You know, over try like basically saying it over the objections of his wife, who's like, that's not really what you should tell our son how to live his life. You know, and there's this ideology or this like you said, this deal with the devil, you know, that and I thought it was interesting how he phrased that, because it almost seems to be contrary to the nature of Christ in the way that, you know, Christ said that of the Pharisees, he said, like, you know, they practice their righteousness in public, but like he says, you know, to pray or to give sort of in private or to yourself and God will reward you, is what he says in the Sermon on the Mount. So it's almost like this, the it is almost that inversion of Christ's idea of righteousness that, you know, but they're taking it to a different level. They're saying, don't practice righteousness in private, practice wickedness in private, you know? And
well, and, oh, sorry, go on.
No, that's fine. Jump in.
Well, and it's also in its own way, if you look at John Connolly, you know, there's that idea of being wise as serpents and innocent as doves. And John Connolly is the inverse of that. He's as innocent as a serpent because of, like, if you look at his motives. But he's also, like, he's as wise as a dove. And I'm going to assume that doves are not known for their wisdom. But, like, you know, just because look at what he allowed himself to get talked into.
Mm-hmm.
Right. No,
you know, he didn't. I think he recognized that he was certainly making compromises for Bulger, but I don't think he realized that he was being played quite as much as he was by Bulger. And so, you know, he is the inverse of, you know, other admonitions of what we are supposed to be in the Bible. And of course, all of these characters are Catholic. Mm-hmm. Nothing against any Catholics listening, but it's just like, you know, they probably use that as something of a cover for their actual actions, and that makes it all the more insidious.
Insidious, yeah. I was gonna say because hypothetically, there is the. I mean, there are the few church scenes that don't really. Mostly just Bulger waiting, you know, it's not really engaging anybody in that. So it seems like this stuff would be in the back of their mind. I feel like lots of, or we got this with Daredevil where there's a Catholic infusion in it. And it's a main character acknowledging the Catholic piece of their background and kind of having to justify it or make penance. But it almost seems like Bulger understands the Catholic background and is being the Black Mass. He's willfully ignoring it and then gives us these scenes, like when he says, if nobody sees it, it didn't happen, when the environment that his family and friends and himself grew up in is one that says nothing is actually hidden from God, who will be the ultimate judge. I mean, we get Luke and Hebrews stating very plainly that all that is hidden will be uncovered and, you know, and brought before God for his judgment. And Bulger just does not care. In fact, he seems to be willfully evangelizing against these ideas. And it seems like when you take that into account, Black Mass, surprisingly, something that I wish I would have known about, I guess maybe if I would have known about Black Mass, could be have a, looking at the movie with that lens at the time of viewing, without having to go back so far and kind of having to kind of replaster it over my viewing experience.
Yeah, that's one of the neat things about titles. I mean, so often I'll just go see a movie and the title is only vaguely connected to the film itself. And it doesn't really bother me that much. I just like, well, they got to call it something. but a lot of the times I think it can be very interesting in that if you know what the title means going in, then it will contextualize everything that you're seeing. But if you don't know what it is going in, then that means you come out with a very specific idea, and then maybe you look up what the title means, and then you suddenly have to rethink everything. And either way, it can be not unlike a piece of music used in the film. It can be used to recontextualize our feelings about what we're seeing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of a neat thing about titles. And so that's one of the things that I like about this title, is because it is infused with meaning. And when, you know, and the meaning is inherently spiritual. And so if you take these characters and their actions, which would not seem to be spiritual in nature, and then you add a spiritual element to it, more specifically the idea of defiantly doing the wrong thing, doing the wrong thing in defiance of the right thing, like not in a vacuum, like you know what the right thing is and you're going completely against it. I feel like that definitely recontextualizes what we are seeing and what we're, or in the case of the book, what we're reading, so that we suddenly realize just how much of a betrayal it is, what he has done, but then also in the part of Bulger, just how dangerous and monstrous he can be when he has taken on almost a spiritual significance to the things that he is doing.
Mm-hmm. So there's this concept that I guess I want to explore a little bit, or at least get an opinion about. And I think that there's been a string of, you know, anti-heroes, the Breaking Bad, the Dexter, and I feel like that's tapering off to some degree. But I feel like there's a reason that we're compelled to watch these people, and part of it is we can connect with human characters. We can connect with imperfect people because we are imperfect. But when we see a movie like this, when it looks like instead of giving us that story arc, we're given a series of really terrible things to try to prove to us that this dude was a terrible dude. It's easy when watching something about a person who is so intentionally bad to just completely separate ourselves from the unfortunate humanity of that person and say, at least I'm not as bad as Whitey Bulger. And do you think that there are people who do you think that's a legitimate concern, that people are going to say, well, I'm good, so at least I'm not Bulger, right? At least I've done better than him. Or what is the difference between us and Whitey Bulger? Socially? Spiritually? Josh?
Well,
take it first.
I don't really know if there's a... Because I think that part of our human condition is to compare ourselves to other people in that way. We almost look for the people in our lives that have a more disastrous life than we do. And we're like, well, you know, our life is pretty bad, but it's not as bad as this person. And that's that can be both a negative, not necessarily a negative or positive. It's like, it can be a couple different kinds of negatives, you know? It can either be a self-righteous view, or it can be, you know, just sort of it can either elevate you or it can further press you down when you compare yourself to those kind of people. You know, that might have it worse than you, because it's not really a fair comparison to make. And I don't necessarily think maybe people be like, well, at least I didn't murder 19 people, because there's not a lot of people who have murdered 19 people. So, you know, but I think that, you know, Whitey Bulger could potentially be a good stand in. It's like, well, I'm, you know, the common thing is like, well, I'm not Hitler, so, you know, at least I'm not Whitey Bulger. At least I didn't murder a bunch of people. At least I'm not like, you know, Satan incarnate.
Setting that bar low.
Right, exactly. Like that's kind of a rough thing. I've actually had people say that before when talking you know, about like where they're at, like as far as if they think they're going to heaven or hell, you know, and being like, that's a really low bar to set when you compare yourself to Hitler right out of the gate. And be like, well, you know, I think I'm not as bad as Hitler is. You're right. There hasn't been a lot of people as bad as him. but, you know, I'm not, is it really that people, you know, with the anti-hero, are people really, really comparing themselves and being like, well, I'm not, you know, I am Walter White. I have good intentions, but I'm doing bad things. You know, or is it like with Whitey Bulger, like I have a fierce loyalty to family, but I murder people because of that loyalty. That might be more common than we think. But maybe in our nice sequestered nicety of life, talking on a podcast using, you know, Apple products and stuff. we don't know anyone like that.
We hope, maybe.
Yeah, I feel like that's a thing that I regularly talk about on my podcast is just, you know, if you're a Christian, I think you have, hopefully, I certainly think the Bible gives you plenty of reason to believe that people are broken, fallen, sinful, whatever, self-centered, whatever you want to say, and that nobody is righteous. No, not one. See, I like to say it that way, just in case the person's like, well, what about this person? No.
Like they've got that look on their face. Like
not even that one.
You know, they start to say something.
Nice.
And you have to cut them off.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the thing is, you know, the whole idea of, well, I'm not Hitler. At least I'm not Hitler. The question is, how did Hitler become Hitler? Who did Hitler comfort himself by saying, well, I'm not as bad as that person.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know what I mean? Like, Hitler didn't do what he did saying, all right, I'm the worst person in history. Here we go. Like, he didn't do that. He thought he was doing something good. And he thought, and it might literally have been like, well, I'm hurting people, but at least I'm not as bad as the Jews. Like, there's always someone... Mm-hmm. Who can say, you can always say, at least I'm not as bad as this person. And then that person can say it about somebody else. You know, a murderer can say, well, at least I didn't rape anybody. A rapist can say, at least I didn't rape a child. Everybody can eventually. We're just measuring ourselves by everybody else, making sure that we're doing kind of okay. And no matter how bad you are, you can probably find somebody worse, even if you have to go to Hitler or Stalin or Pol Pot or anything like that and think, well, at least I'm not as bad as them. It's like, yeah, okay. And like you said, that's a low bar. But wouldn't you rather be saying, not even that I'm better than this person, but it's just like, well, I've done a lot of terrible things. Regardless, I've hurt people that I care about in some way, shape, or form. And that is, and I did it probably for my own gain. And that is a bad thing. And it is that exact instinct that causes Whitey Bulger to do what he does. And a big thing that I like to talk about in regards to mob movies is family is usually the most important thing. And family becomes an idol, and it's the idol that allows them to murder everybody except their family. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. Right. Here's what's wonderful about the Godfather films is that mm-hmm. it's like you don't go against the family. Family is everything. And Michael Corleone and Vito Corleone, they're able to convince themselves that because they're family men, that they are not selfish. They're doing what they have to do to protect their family. And that's true right up until the end of Godfather Part 2, when you discover, yeah. No, it's not even really about family, is it? It's about you. You've managed to use family as a shield and say that you're not selfish, but it was never about family. It's about you. And that's something that is said at the end of Breaking Bad as well. You know, and so... To me, I feel like it's best to just acknowledge what in my opinion is the best and worst villain in all of film history, which is not a thing I say lightly. Noah Cross in Chinatown, have you guys seen Chinatown?
No.
Okay, I will not say what he does, but he does some pretty horrendous stuff, and when confronted with it, he says, I don't blame myself. He says, because, you know, most people never have to face the fact that in the right circumstances, they're capable of anything. Mm. And that's the thing, like, he's using it as a justification. To me, I view it as a warning and just being like, I am not above anybody. In the right circumstances, mm-hmm. I am capable of anything, you know? And so I'm sure there are a number of people that would look at Whitey Bulger and say, well, at least I'm not that. And it's like, yes, good for you. You're not that. But what can people look at you about and say, well, at least I'm not that.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's plenty. No. And so, you know, that can be, I choose to view that as a comfort. You know, it's a sad comfort that, like, yeah, I guess I'm pretty bad too, but it's like, but I know we're all bad, and thus we're all equally bad. We as a species we're pretty self-centered. We're pretty broken, but that's not the end of the story.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then again, that might go back to the point of what we've kind of all said, is that Connolly's story would have been maybe more compelling and a lot more easy to connect with, or it would have been a more impactful connection, because he thinks he's doing something good, but then it essentially turns out that he, you know, his deal with the devil led to the deaths of tons of people and, you know, the embarrassment of the FBI and all these other things. So basically, like, that would have been better. Like, seeing how one guy's, you know, golden deal that he makes to accomplish an objective and rise to the top is actually just the very thing that eventually brings him down.
And in his mind, I'm sure he, like you said, I'm sure he does think he's doing a good thing, because his constant refrain is, hey, we're trying to get these Italian mobsters. And it's just like, oh, okay. Well, is that about you doing your job, or is it about you and having a certain degree of Irish pride and just getting the competitors out?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, now the Italians are gone. Hey, look who took their place. Now what do we do? And it's, to me, it's like Michael Corleone with his brother, which is just like, oh, you're using this as a justification for doing what you're doing, but once that's gone, we see what you actually are. And, you know, it's best instead to just, because any idol that you set up will probably be an idol worth killing for.
I think that's just a really great point. I love this line of thought, because when I talk to people, especially people who are especially not Christian, but typically not religious or anything like that, and you start talking about, like, the depravity of humankind, like, there's always this almost like relative morality, like, just be a good person, just do enough good things, and basically always, just like you said, Tyler, have someone that you're better than. So you can say, at least I'm better than that person. And I mean, I've gotten in a number of conversations with people who will say things like, oh, that person, that despicable thing they've done, it's unforgivable. And, you know, I kind of like, wow, where's the line for unforgivable things? Like, what can you forget? What can be forgiven and not forgiven in a morally relative society? Like what happened? Like, is that the end of the story? They have no hope. Like, no matter what they do, there's no contrition that they can have that will allow them to get back in good graces. They will always be the person who someone is better than. That's terrible. And like in your life, have you not done anything, or do you not make decisions that are selfish, that have hurt people? Like, does everyone see you as good as you see you?
Yeah.
And, you know, I would posit that the answer is no, but, you know, from that point of view, when you can't see that all of humankind is, you know, depraved, you know, are the best we have to offer as humanity outside of Christ is still depraved. Like, the people you look up to the most, the people who you think are the squeaky cleanest, that, like, there's still a lot of terrible, terrible stuff going on in the heart of that person, probably in the actions that are, you know, done when no one sees it.
And think of how trapping it can be to think in these terms. Like, imagine, you know, somebody who cheated on his wife. And you, in your mind, like, well, that's the absolute worst thing. I could never do that. You know, no matter how, like, I may look at porn or something like that, but at least I'm not actually seeking somebody out. Mm-hmm. At least I'm not actually cheating on my wife. That would be the worst. And then now imagine one day you actually cheat on your wife. You have now become, by your own standards, the worst person. Mm-hmm. Now, one of two things will happen. You will either then try to find somebody who's done something worse so you can live with yourself, or you literally will not be able to live with yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, as opposed to, and obviously there are worldly consequences to what we are, to what we're talking about.
Yes.
And those are things that I'm not saying you should try to avoid. I'm talking about in the general acceptability of one's person. And on a spiritual and a metaphysical level, it's like if you set the bar as this is what's unacceptable, you'd be surprised how quickly you can get to that or how easily you can get to that, maybe without even realizing it. And then once you're there, you have become, in your own mind, the worst person ever. And so what do you do with that? Like, your world will be shattered somehow, unless, of course, you come to realize early on that everybody is capable of everything. Mm-hmm. Everybody. In any if the circumstances are just right, everybody is capable of everything, including you, including the person you idolize, and including the person that you look down upon.
Yep.
Everyone can do everything, and that is why God's grace extends to everyone, including you.
And with that encouragement, because I love that, because it's that tension that the gospel lives in, right? Like,
yeah.
That, like, no, you have no idea how terrible it is, but no, it's also okay because you have no idea how much grace there is for that.
Yeah.
And, I hope that despite, you know, our ramblings here, that can be an encouragement, because when I was looking at making the notes for this film, and I was looking at how, I've repeated this, I know personally, and we were kind of all hitting around this, that it's a set of circumstances, not really that story that we were hoping for. I was like, what are we really going to get thematically out of this? But when you really take a step back and think about a life examined, that does open up a whole lot of ideas that we can explore through. And I was actually being encouraged before we even had to have this conversation. So it's really good that it played out, I think, this way.
And to end the encouragement, not end it, to end on it, and maybe even a more specifically encouraging note, this is a true story.
Mm-hmm.
Whitey Bulger was a horrible monster, and I do actually applaud the filmmakers for incorporating things into the film that would make it clear he is a monster.
Yes.
The whole Juno Temple scene is horrendous.
Yeah.
And so Whitey Bulger is a monster who wreaked havoc on people's lives. And by the way, I highly recommend seeking out the documentary Whitey, which is on Netflix, and you'll get a really strong sense of just how monstrous he can be. It's a wonderful film. Go see it. But anyway, so he was a monster, and John Connolly was the guy who let it happen. Both of these men are prime candidates for redemption. If they went to Christ and said, look at the horrible things I have done. I cannot save myself. I feel so horrible for what I have done. Please, please forgive me. They would be forgiven.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, some people would look at that and say, that's horrible. But, and I just think like, okay, well, yes, I guess if you want to look at it a certain way, it is horrible. But if you want to look at it a different way, if you're big on comparing yourself, then look at it this way. If Whitey Bulger can be forgiven, somebody who's done unspeakable crimes in the view of our world, then you can also be forgiven and you'll be fine. You know, it should be an encouraging thing to mm-hmm. us, as opposed to just something that makes us angry about, like, well, why doesn't he get his comeuppance? It's just like, well, why doesn't anybody? Because somebody already did for us.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's basically echoing the words of Paul, isn't it? When he says, you know, like, there's no greater sinner than I, like, but grace was still extended to me. You know, we kind of forget that before Paul, when he was Saul, we kind of forget that he took part in, you know, murdering and imprisoning Christians. We kind of seem to forget that part of it. And it's like, you know, in the eyes, that would have been just as scandalous as, you know, like someone like Whitey Bulger saying, like, well, you know, if I think he's still alive. I don't think he's dead yet. He's in prison. But, you know, if he was to be like, yeah, I'm a born again Christian, we'd be like, no, you're not. No, you're not. There's no way you could ever understand God's mm-hmm. grace. And we kind of forget that even the guy who wrote a lot of the New Testament was a criminal. And and it says in the New Testament that for a lot of years people didn't trust him. I mean, essentially what you can infer from Acts is that people didn't trust him because of who he was before he became Christian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's really great.
Well, and not just that, but so we have, you know, outside of Christ, there are probably four or five like big, big characters in the Bible. One of them being Paul, who was taken from, you know, taken on that journey that you just described. But then we also have David, who is described as a man after God's own heart. And I mean, murder, like adultery, like what did he not do? Really? Mm. He was lying. So many terrible things. And that's what it looks like to live a life after God's own heart. And I think it's so incredibly amusing to me that David's life is often pointed to by, I don't want to just like pick on atheists, but you know, non-Christians, as like, that's, you know, this is the God you're serving, one who is okay with, you know, murderers and adulterers. Like, why would I want to serve a God who's okay with that type of person? And it's just such a misunderstanding of basically the rest of the entire book. But
and if you think about it, you know, you said like there's this attitude of like, well, what could Whitey Bulger possibly understand about God's grace? Well, if you look at it from a certain way, he might be able to understand in a much deeper way than people who have lived an upright life their entire lives. I mean, that's the prodigal son. Like, there's the one who still has his father's favor, but hasn't done anything wrong. Then there's the one who's lived in a horrible life of depravity and has squandered all goodwill, and then comes back to his father. Like, he might have an even deeper appreciation for God's grace because of the terrible things he's done. And the same could go with Whitey Bulger.
Yeah, I would say, I'm going to totally butcher this, but you know, it's, when they're talking about, you know, who is more grateful, the one who had the greater debt or the smaller debt.
Yeah.
Like you can't really understand if you felt like you never owed very much, then you never understand how great it is to be released from that debt. So, I feel like we could go on and on about how encouraging this is to us personally, and I hope it has been to anyone listening. But let's wrap it up.
Okay.
And we do that by talking about our least favorite and then favorite moments. So, Tyler, what was it about this film that you wish was either done better, or a performance you didn't like, or just a scene you didn't like? What was it that didn't sit right with you?
I think just in general, the missed opportunities, relationships that could have been better explored. I mean, you have one brother who's a crime boss and another who is a successful and popular politician. These are brothers and they're completely two sides, you know, completely opposites. And so, like, you know, there was a TV show on Showtime called Brotherhood that sort of explored that, and it's just like, yeah, because it's a thing that deserves to be explored, whether it be that or Connolly and his wife or whatever. It's just like, there are so many different angles you could have come at this story, except, you know, but they chose the most obvious one. And I feel like the moment you even start to entertain the notion that, hey, maybe this is Connolly's story, maybe this is the FBI's story, or maybe this is a family story. The moment you start doing that, the film becomes infinitely more interesting than it was.
Agreed, Josh.
Yeah, I would say the same thing. And even like, I a lot of the choices, there's just, again, it's those missed opportunities. It's almost like a lot of great scenes, but without a common thread to really kind of put them all together. I thought that was the biggest miss, and what ended up making the movie kind of dull. I feel like some of the later scenes in the movie were much more compelling and could have stood in for a lot of the stuff that were in the beginning portions of the movie. Almost kind of, you know, go further down the rabbit hole of how bad Bulger is, but, you know, don't really see it till the end of the movie, you know, where Connolly's realizing those kind of things. So it's like, it's almost a missed opportunity to tell a better story was probably the biggest, like, come on of this movie, or like the hardest, most difficult part to swallow, of having all this potential and a giant cast and kind of kind of missing the mark.
No, I love the way that you put it. It felt like a whole bunch of really great scenes, but just didn't have like the glue to put it together.
Yeah.
Because any time a scene, I talked about this earlier. Anytime a scene would start with this character that I only get to see for like one or two scenes, I'm like, man, what was that relationship like? Can I dive into that? Any of these things, like Tyler, you pointed out, you could have literally gone with any of these relationships in this movie and just focused on that and made a pretty compelling story. And instead we get a whole lot, like not even a vignette, but just like these little like pieces that don't add up to like a full puzzle. And that's frustrating. Especially again, Josh, you know, you pointed out like wasting this cast basically. I mean, not a complete waste, but you know, so let's leave on a high note, hopefully. But what was, Tyler, what was your favorite part of this film?
I do think, just the performances in general, I don't think there was a bad performance in it. I think, and some of the performances are so good that they elevate the material. Mm-hmm. I think Johnny Depp especially, I think Joel Edgerton with his commitment to being a guy that is not fun to watch. And on that level, you know, that's where you find the intensity, you know, and you talked about, you know, the early scene in which, you know, W. Earl Brown, a performer who I always enjoy seeing ever since first seeing him in Deadwood, as this mob enforcer just keeps like eating peanuts after like licking his fingers and just the way Whitey looks at that. It's moments like that are done mostly silently where they just trust the actor's expressions to tell the story and tell what they're feeling and grow the tension. And I feel like, you know, in the world of like certain types of snooty film critics, acting is not seen as a major part of filmmaking. It's seen as like, yes, that's, we have to have somebody to put in front of the camera and they do a really good job. But the real art comes with the editing and the cinematography. And while I understand what they're talking about, it's like, yeah, but the acting can really set the tone for the film and can set the pace for the film. And I feel like this is a film that was going to live or die by its acting. And I feel like this is a C+ script that is, I think, elevated to a solid B level film by the power of the performers.
Yeah, it's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
Josh.
Yeah, I think, you know, how I've jokingly billed this movie in most of the places where I put reviews is that, you know, like the only part of the movie that has any stakes was the scene with steaks. and I think that that dinner table scene is so great. And I think it's almost indicative of, even though I know it doesn't directly deal with Connolly, it's at Connolly's house, but that scene between, is it John Morris is the FBI, the other corrupt FBI agent along with Connolly and Bulger. And, you know, Bulger kind of essentially is saying, because he divulged the family secret, the family recipe for steak marinade, you know, that he might, you know, be willing to give up other secrets just as fast. And he says, you know, that can get you buried real quick. And, you know, there's just this terror moment. And he's like, oh, I'm only kidding. And I feel like that's, you know, and then they just breathe, you know, they both breathe like a sigh of relief, like, oh, man, he was just kidding. And I feel like that's a good way of putting what the relationship between Connolly and the FBI and Bulger was like. It was kind of like, we're terrified that he is as terrible as it sounds like he is. But, oh, okay, he's just kidding. Okay, he's not a terrible person. Oh, that's great. So I thought that worked so well and communicated so much, and it was really well done. And, you know, even the other part, afterwards with, Connolly's wife was pretty cringe inducing. And then I think shortly after that was that Juno Temple scene, which I'm never going to say is my favorite scene, but it's one of the better scenes in the movie. Mm. So even though it's terrifying and just awful.
I think that's I would say that it'd be hard pressed for me to think of better scenes than the ones you just mentioned, mainly because there are stakes. Like for the most part, you know, they set up Bulger and they set up his character. And so, you know, where most scenes are going, you know, someone wasn't loyal, you know how the scene's kind of going to end, but when he's sitting across, you don't know, because you know he is super into loyalty. Is he being serious? Is he about to kill a guy at a table? Or is he going to let it pass? Or is he just joking? Or is, you know, he pretending? What is going through his head? Like, you don't know. He's crazy, and you're totally buying it. And I think that's excellent. I also think, I mean, just in general, the way, Tyler, you describe it, you know, C+ script elevated to a B, that's basically how, when I had to, you know, write a couple lines to review it, that's basically how I felt. Just, if the performances weren't so good, then I probably would have not cared for this film at all. It would have been, like, below average. So that leaves me with one final, I guess, the final thought, and it can be a yes or no, or you can elaborate, but we all seem to be really high on these performances, and we've already mentioned a ton of performances, but do you think, I mean, obviously having not seen the rest of the films this year, that anyone's performance in this could be Oscar worthy, or not Oscar worthy, but nominated anyway? come Oscar season. I don't know how to be political about how the Oscars don't typically get it super right.
Well, I'll say this, for the last couple of years at Battleship Pretension, we've done the BPs.
Mm-hmm.
And so our various writers and podcasters and contributors, there's about 30, 35 in all, we submit for various categories, and then, you know, put them all together in a final five, and then everybody votes from there, and then we do a ceremony that is actually a great deal of fun. I like it quite a bit, but one of the categories is one that I, ever since seeing, I think, The Insider, is a category that I always thought the Oscars should introduce, which is supporting performance under 15 minutes. Because when it comes right down to it, you know, William Hurt being in A History of Violence for 8 minutes is not going to be able to compare with George Clooney being in Syriana throughout the entire film. And obviously one of them won and the other did not. And so when I'm thinking, so throughout the year, I update my BP's submission list. And basically every time I see a movie, I go to that list and see if there's any categories that I feel like it deserves a possible nomination. And I think with this one, it would probably be maybe a best actor for Johnny Depp, but definitely what we call the Bruce McGill Award for best supporting performance under 15 minutes. That one would be for Peter Sarsgaard, who, once again, I think does a really great job. But he's not in it enough that the Oscars would ever consider him.
Mm.
And then as far as the Oscars themselves, I think there probably will be a push. If the billboards around Los Angeles are any indication, there will probably be a push for best actor. And
best actor Oscars for Depp.
Okay. And then the Oscars being stupid the way they are, a supporting actor push for Joel Edgerton, even though he is a co-lead. But that's the way they do it. So I feel like that's probably what you'll get, if anything. Like, if the film makes a bit more money, then maybe it could be seen as viable. But it could also be seen as this year's Amelia, which is, you know, a kind of an Oscar movie that comes out maybe a little bit too early and doesn't have quite enough good press to really make it the whole way. And so I do think, for the most part, it'll be forgotten around Oscar time.
Gotcha.
Mm. It's interesting how the billboards are kind of like, you know, the weather patterns of the Oscars in LA.
Oh, it's insane. It's insane.
Josh, anything else to
That's
throw in
funny.
There?
You know, I couldn't agree. Like, I honestly feel like this movie, just the way that, not living in LA and seeing all the billboards, you know, that, Depp's performance was kind of being hyped as being something that would get him like a best actor mm-hmm. nomination or a nod. I guess I couldn't argue. Well, no, I could argue with it. I mean, I can argue with anything I want.
it's free country.
But, it wouldn't be the worst performance to pick, to put on there. I can't think of anything off the top of my head where it's like, what are they? Oh, well, you know, I think if I want to make a comparison, it's like Eddie Redmayne when he was nominated for A Theory of Everything. I did not feel like he was even close to the strongest performance in that movie. And I didn't particularly like that movie that much. And so it was even a bigger shock that he won. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I guess I couldn't put it past them, but
the key is to be really cynical and negative about the Oscars. And then his win makes all kinds of sense.
That's very true.
Yeah. I could do that if I wanted to. But I'm still holding out hope, and you know, yeah. it would make my Oscar parties a huge bummer if I was like that all the time. You know, like come to my party and listen to me gripe about the Oscars the whole time.
Well, you don't have to be super vocal about it. It's just about managing your expectations.
Nice.
Just Tyler bringing a little bit of wisdom to the situation.
Or you can do what I do and my friends do and have done for the last 3 years. You're welcome in advance for what I'm about to say. So we, years ago, I'd been listening to my friends talk about fantasy football for years, and I thought there's got to be a way to make this work with the Oscars. And I couldn't figure it out. And then finally, a few years ago, some friends and I were kind of brainstorming, and we got it, which is, here's what you do. You don't pick one movie. You pick different categories. So you could have your little dream team of picture, director, actor, actress, but they're all from different movies. It's just, who, you know, like last year, whoever got J.K. Simmons for supporting actor was in good shape. But here's the other thing. You can't only have it be about the Oscars. That's only one ceremony. So we have our fantasy awards draft. It's coming up. Probably in about 2 weeks we're going to do it. And it covers a predetermined number of critics awards, Golden Globes, Guild Awards, and then Oscars. And then you can make trades and all that, and you get a certain number of points for a nomination and a win and stuff like that. And then everybody throws in $15, and whoever has the most points at the end of Oscar night gets the money. It's awesome. I love it so much. It's actually reinvigorated my enthusiasm for awards season, which in Los Angeles can be oppressive in like December and January. But now I'm just super excited. Like every time, like, oh, a new Critics Awards came out. Let's see if I got any points. So
nice.
So once again, you're welcome.
So do you have like a rule set and some papers for this?
What are you talking about?
Like, do you have like who do you organize this, or does this someone else that?
We all kind of know the rules, and we've had to change them as we go along. But and if somebody has a question that we haven't thought about, then we as a group, there's only like seven of us, we as a group decide what the rule should be and stuff like that. Like we toyed with the idea of if you win a Golden Globe, you get negative points because the Golden Globes are ridiculous. But nobody wanted to do that. There are rules. And anytime somebody new comes in, we will explain the rules to them and that sort of thing. So,
Well, until I have the rules written down so I can replicate this, I'm reserving my thank you.
Okay, well, I'll see if I can write them down and I'll send them to you.
Because you have to understand that there is a thank you, like, ready. It's in the chamber. It's ready to head your way.
Okay.
But right now it's a, why did you tell me this is possible? I'm actually kind of mad at you a little bit right now.
Because you're excited to do it, but you don't know the structure yet?
Exactly. Like, you told me there was this really great thing and I can't have it. You know,
well, that's the beautiful thing is if you get your friends together, you can make up your own rules.
But I don't want
you don't
to do
have
it
to go
all
with
ours. I ain't got that kind of time.
That's fine.
Yeah, okay. And you've already perfected it, you know, like perfected in as much as it's going to be tweaked from year to year.
Well, there's not that many rules. I will go ahead and I'll write them down. I'll send them to you, Josh. I'll send them to you as well, as you are obviously as interested in this as the rest of us.
This sounds like, well, I'm letting Mikey's enthusiasm get there, because this is like this sounds incredible.
Yeah, like I hate sports and I hate most people that like them, and so this is like a really exciting thing for me. Even though, like, the first year I came in dead last, the second year I was right in the middle, and then this last year, oh, there was like a last minute surge. Because I had Birdman for a lot of stuff, and literally, if I had not made a trade, a stupid, stupid trade where I got rid of Steve Carell, who didn't win, but he still got enough nominations. If I had not gotten rid of him early on because I thought the Academy, I thought the critics and stuff had turned on him, if I had not gotten rid of him, then the points I would have gotten for his nomination for the Screen Actors Guild and for the Oscars would have won. It was very frustrating to be like 8 points away. I wound up being in third place. There was only a few points between third and second and second and first.
So you can say that you lost by a nose.
Ow. Josh, right there at the end. Look at that.
Yeah, I guess I could say that.
But why would I? No, well, I mean, because it obviously is different, but the best that we've been able to find up to this point has been the Fantasy Movie League, which we started. We didn't start, obviously, but there's a site called Fantasy Movie League. We started a real world theology group, and you are more than welcome to join. I kind of wish you would. It is the fantasy football for moviegoers. You have 8 screens. You get a set amount of cash every week, and you basically pick how the box office is going to do by making your own kind of theater. And on Monday, the box office totals come in. Whoever has the highest box office wins the week, and then they're split into 4 seasons throughout the year. So,
now I'm not opposed to that, but I will say that box office is not a thing that I'm great at,
and I'm not either, which is kind of fun because
I'm frustratingly terrible.
Yes,
at Fantasy Movie League, I can't understand how I pick stuff and I still lose every week.
So it's funny because I just had this conversation with my wife, and she's like. She's like, well, you've still got to be doing well, right? Because, I mean, obviously, I have a podcast about film. I should know about film, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, I did well during the summer when I could guess how people were going to react to movies that should be good or should be bad. I do terrible in August and September when there's nothing, well, not nothing, but for the most part, very terrible movies out there. And I don't know what would compel anyone to see any of these films. So I'm just throwing darts at a dartboard, you know, and I'm terrible.
Sometimes, in some cases, the more you know, especially with box office, the more you know, the stronger an opinion you have, the worse you'll do. Like, and I'll say that once again, living in Los Angeles has completely thrown me off as far as what like. If I, based on billboards in Los Angeles and just how much it was advertised, I would have thought American Ultra was going to do great.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was heavily marketed around here, but it didn't do well at all. Well, and it's just like, and I would not have known based on where I live.
Well, that's the same conversation I would typically tell people about the Oscars. I used to guess really well about the Oscars. And then, Laura and I started going to see the animated shorts and the live action shorts and stuff like that. And once I started watching almost everything nominated for an award, my guessing drastically plummeted, and my cynicism, drastically increased. Being like, what? This one? Really? I saw that.
Yeah.
It was terrible. So
yeah, it happens.
But, you know, here to there, this has been an incredibly productive tangent, I hope, for most of the listeners. Because like I said, I'm assuming that if people are listening to this, that they're really into lots of these things anyway. So, thank you for the tangent, Tyler.
Oh, you're welcome.
I'm excited to give you a thank you for the rules.
This is going to be this is an exciting time for you.
It is. I'm giddy. I'm shaking with anticipation.
It's the best.
It is the great.
I hate losing, and I still love it. It's my like one of my favorite times of year.
Yeah. Okay. Well, with that, if you want to send Tyler or Josh a thank you, then I would love to let you know how to do that. So, Tyler, how can people follow you, follow your work, or jump into conversation with you about all this stuff? Just where can they find you on the web, et cetera?
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so I've got two websites. I have BattleshipPretension.com, which is primarily a podcast that I've been hosting co-hosting for over 8 years. And it's me and my friend David, and we just talk about various topics week after week. Language warning, by the way, if you happen to listen to that one, and unfortunately a lot of it is me, I'm sorry. And then not
like
all
you speak Spanish a lot, like I don't understand.
he is an LA.
I do often say, pardon my French. That's not true. I don't say that. You know, not all of us can be a pastor of adult and family discipleship at Appleton Gospel Church.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah.
So
that's like setting the bar high. We talked about setting the bar low before.
Right.
That's
absolutely
setting the bar high.
But yeah, and so so that's battleshipretention.com. Then you can also go to morethanonelesson.com, which I think the listeners of this podcast would be more interested in, which is I've been doing that for about 6 years. And my various co-hosts and I talk about a movie from a Christian standpoint, which, not unlike this show, talking about it artistically and thematically. By the time this goes up, I think we will have an episode about Whiplash posted, which I'm excited about. But then also, we are going into October, which for us is a time of year that we call Halloween times. And every week we talk about a horror movie, new or old. So we'll be talking about The Babadook. We'll be talking about It Follows. But we'll also be talking about Rosemary's Baby. Mm-hmm. And then a few others, because there will be 5 Thursdays in October. It's going to be very exciting. And then also, I've started a third podcast, but you can find it through battleshippretension.com. This one is not as interesting for most people. Meanwhile, it's like my favorite thing now. I host it with my wife. And on it, we talk about the reality competition show, Survivor. That show is called Worth Playing For. And the first episode of the season starts for us in 1 hour, and I cannot wait.
That is so funny, because I've never seen an episode of Survivor, and I totally, right before we got you on the call, made a Survivor reference to Josh about something that I was doing. And
well, what must this reference have been if you've never seen it?
Well, I'm assuming that there was an alliance and voting, you know, things that I could probably pick up from the commercials or, you know,
fair
the,
enough,
the promos. So,
and you guys should start watching.
He was just
so
basically
much fun
making something up. So,
oh, okay,
yeah. I even caveated my comparison with the fact that, but I just assume that's what happens because I've never seen it. If only someone had a podcast about it.
Well, it turns out there are many people that have a podcast about it, which is why ours is never going to be that popular. It's more just a fun thing that I get to do with my wife.
Mm-hmm. Those are amazing things, and yeah, I fully endorse them. So, Twitter, Facebook, anything like that?
You can find me on Facebook. Just type in Tyler Smith, or you can probably find me better through Battleship Pretension. Mm-hmm. And then you can... I have 2 Twitter accounts, at Tyler Pretension or at More Lessons. And I think that is everywhere you can get me.
Oh, wait. I don't think I'm following Tyler Pretensions. So, cool. I'll make sure that's in the show notes. Josh, how can people get a hold of you?
My Twitter handle is Hey, It's That Josh. That's me on Twitter. You can also find me on the Facebook for Movie Lovers, Letterboxd, where I'm writing and reading everything all the time. Love Letterboxd. Love talking about movies on Letterboxd. All of the writing that I do, and pretty much everywhere you'll find me on the internet, is going to be right here at Real World Theology. Writing a couple articles a week. Got lots of stuff going on. Apparently going to be on the podcast every time from now on.
No.
So I've been on quite a bit recently. So
I hope you've enjoyed Josh, because he won't be around for a while.
Woo!
But here's the thing. Good news for any Appleton listeners. if you were to happen to go to Appleton Gospel Church and ask for the pastor of adult and family discipleship, you're going to get Josh Crabb.
Josh Crabb.
You will definitely find me. And you can find some of my sermons there. I'm preaching again on October 18th.
Oh, what's the topic? Is it about adult and family discipleship?
I hope it is. Oh, please be. Please be. Please be.
No, it's not.
Nope.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry for running this joke into the ground, but for some reason I find it hilarious.
I think it'll play well.
I think it will.
I think
it'll play really well, because almost nobody here actually calls me that ever. They're always just like, so you're like the associate pastor, right?
Kind of like,
and then you immediately said, sir, please. I am the pastor of adult and family discipleship.
Please get it right. It's on my card.
You're like, I'm an anauropist. Thank you very much.
Good stuff. I don't think I've ever referenced my day job on the show before. So only as a pastor. So never as the pastor of adult and family discipleship.
If you had to narrow it down, what exactly would you say, like, your specific role at Appleton Gospel is? Like, if it wasn't just pastor, would there be like a specific group that you pastor?
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, I handle like our small groups ministry, and like, I do a lot of stuff with our children's ministry, 'cause we have a lot of kids at our church. So, those are kind of like the adult and family stuff.
Oh, okay. Adult and family. That sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
And I assume there's some discipleship involved.
Oh, there's plenty of it. There's discipleship flying around everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. It's dripping down the walls, this discipleship.
it really comes through in the way that you talk.
Oh, well, I'm glad that comes across.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I think the good part of this is that most of this joke happened before I think we started the actual podcast.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So boy. I don't think the audience is going to be tired of it by the time we get to this point.
I guess I should probably explain to the audience, just in case, because they've probably heard us reference it a bunch and they're like, I don't understand. Let me explain. Josh is the pastor of adult and family discipleship at Appleton Gospel Church.
Which makes so much more sense now when you say right. it that way.
So, like, in case you thought this was like a real non sequitur, mm-hmm. that's why we've been making jokes about him being pastor of adult and family discipleship at Appleton Gospel Church, is because that is indeed what he is.
Because reality yes. is stranger than fiction. So,
indeed, it is.
I'm apparently sure, my I'm job sure, is a joke.
I'm sure there are listeners thinking, like, how could anybody possibly get paid for such a ridiculous title? And the thing is, like, you know, people get paid for all kinds of ridiculous things.
Exactly.
And just because Josh has an absolute BS job that literally requires nothing of him.
Exactly.
You know, that he can just be podcasting all day long. Mm-hmm. Look, yeah. it's a real job, and I'm sure it makes some kind of impact on somebody somewhere.
See, that's the thing, Tyler. I feel like right now the audience is like, get out of my head. putting words to my thoughts.
Are you reading my mind? What's going on?
You are right now. You are the audience's Tyler Durden. Like, that's what's going on right now.
Oh my gosh, so excited!
I must confess that my job is just merely a front for a all male terrorist organization.
Hmm. Whoa, man! Oh man!
Wow, that's
I gotta say, you probably should have picked a better title because you're not fooling anybody.
It's right there in the title.
Yeah. It's just like people read that and they're like, okay, so this is obviously a front because, I mean, look at all those words together. It's ridiculous.
None of that makes sense.
So you're saying it would have been better to call myself just terrorist?
Yeah.
And yeah, because they're like, well, certainly he wouldn't be so upfront about that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He would have misdirected in some way.
If you had said that you were a terrorist, people might have said, like, well, he probably is not a terrorist. If I had to guess, I'd say he's probably a pastor of adult and family discipleship. At Appleton Gospel Church. Off the top of my head, I feel like that's probably what he is if he says he's a terrorist.
Oh, man. This joke has jumped the shark and then beaten the shark to death and started jumping it again.
So you can follow me at Fizzification on Twitter. You can follow the show at Real World Theo. Please do it. Thank you for sticking with this joke for this long. This is amazing. I know you all stopped listening a long time ago. Because, you know, we were talking about something that obviously didn't exist. But thanks for being here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks for listening. Thanks to you, the guests, for being so incredibly entertaining about a movie that was only meh. And follow them on social media. I'll make sure their stuff's on the web. I'll make sure it's at the site. Go check it out. Thanks for taking time to make a part of your week. Until next episode, remember that story is powerful, entertainment is not mindless, and that we have a long list of movies to go see now, like Chinatown and Whitey. Bye-bye.
Amen.
But that's the
Josh,
same thing.
Have I met you before?
No, you haven't.
It's nice to meet you. Nice looking at your Facebook page right now in like a super creepy way.
Oh, cool. Sounds great.
But Josh is like my partner in crime at Real World now. So,
well, I'll tell you one thing, he is the pastor of adult and family discipleship at Appleton Gospel Church. Is that correct?
Yes. I'm on Facebook right now. Isn't that what you're supposed to do? Like in all the hacking movies, now I'm supposed to like try and like hack back at you or something like that. Like, oh no, he's on my Facebook page and I have to go on and block everything.
Oh yeah, sorry. Just, no, well, as a pastor, you probably should have had that stuff blocked anyway, but that's fine.
Really? I mean, as a pastor, you're totally transparent, you know? Like,
right, absolutely.
You're living your life out there.
Hey, we're not perfect, just forgiving them, all
right?
That sounds like I have the a t-shirt worst that says idea that. Ever.
Yeah.
And then let's see. Yeah, I mean, I just feel like, you know, as a pastor of adult and family discipleship at Appleton Gospel Church, I feel like it's a thing that you would really benefit from.
How could you know?
And I do know, word on the street is that you did, Josh, study social science Broadfield at University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. But that's, and so as,
you know,
somebody
funny,
who did that, and somebody who went to
creepy.
Brookfield Central High School, let me try it in a creepy way. Hang on.
So I see that you were a pastor of adult and family discipleship. I like that adult part. How's that?
Did
that do the job?
I think that's the best part.
All right, so this is my last time on the podcast because now I have to fold up my front and move.
Yeah.
Hey, but
yeah, because now you'll be, you know, you'll be in Milwaukee as the pastor of adult and family discipleship at Milwaukee Gospel Church.
That doesn't seem like I moved far enough. unless that's the next front. Is that there's no way that a guy who had to fold up with a fake front for a job only moved 2 hours south. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. We're all best friends.
Exactly. Oh. We have so much in common.